The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
That is very good.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Cricket Podcast. I'm Jack Hope, and today, after a two-week break, I'm joined by Max Roy Brown. How are you, Max? Good to have you back.
Hello, yeah, good, thank you. Glad to be back, of course, on a nice, unseasonably sunny day in the UK in the summer. Sad to miss out the last couple of weeks with some interesting chat that we had about Pakistan and then the series, the then upcoming series and now ongoing series. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. And filling in for Ross today, we're excited to be joined by one of the most recognisable voices in cricket broadcasting. One of the game's true polymaths. Welcome to the Cricket Podcast. How are you doing, Daniel Norcross?
Oh, I'm absolutely fantastic. I mean, as I say, it's a couple of degrees cooler than I'd like it to be here in London at about 34. But nothing is better, is it, than days before a test match when you get to sort of think about what's going to happen and you can sit in the garden, you can listen to county cricket, you can read a really terrible novel and get burnt and drink wine and gin and tonic and be happy, which is a rare thing, frankly, in 2020.
Well, I heartily agree. On this episode of the Cricket Podcast, we will be talking about last week's excellent first test between England and Pakistan. We'll be having a look forward to the second test with a quick diversion to discuss James Anderson's future. And then we'll be having a chat with Daniel about some of the broader issues in cricket today. But before we start with any of that, fellas, I have a personal issue that I need some help with.
Don't worry, it's not that personal.
This Sunday, I was bowling my leg spin. It was going pretty well. 5 overs, 20 for 3 at one point. And then I had a sudden attack of the yips. And I don't mean like a couple of balls down the leg side. I mean, I was bowling the ball straight into the floor by my feet. And I don't know if you've ever done that before, but the ball makes this horrible thudding sound that kind of echoes around the pitch. Everyone's silent because, well, obviously you've just done the worst thing you can possibly do as a bowler. And then the ball trickled away towards a point or square leg, depending on which foot I bowled it next to. And then the umpire is called dead ball. So that happened to me 4 or 5 times in a couple of overs. And was intensely embarrassing. Do either of you have any advice about how I may be able to cure this affliction?
Well, do you know, it's funny you should say that because it's sort of in my hitting zone. There's a chap called David Papineau, who is a philosopher at the University of London, who did a serious study on the yips because he was absolutely fascinated by it. You know, how does somebody who is an elite sportsman, usually happens to left-arm spinners, didn't it? Yeah. I've never seen you before, but you look trim. You don't look like a leg spinner, actually. You're a bit thin for a leg spinner. They're usually slightly chunkier, aren't they? But it's in your mind. And obviously it's the anticipation of failure and humiliation that is getting you down, right? So you're projecting into a future. So what you've got to do, I mean, I say this as somebody who's never had the yips and really don't take my advice as professional advice. If anybody out there has got the yips and is listening. But essentially what you've got to do is clear your mind of your anxiety of the future and recollect the success of the past. So where you have 5 overs, 3 for 20, which incidentally is brilliant leg spin figures. I'm imagining a couple of fours off the half trackers through backwards square leg.
Just three people on the boundary at Cow Corner.
Yeah, well, two of them were caught there, but he will also have bowled the perfect leg break in there. The one ball out of the 30 that he bowled that pitched on leg stump and hit the top of off, because that's what leggies do. So really, you've just got to get back into that place where you think back to that ball and visualise, I'm now actually, you know, bowling your leggy, visualise that ball. What you're, obviously the yips is terror of the immediate future.
That's sage advice. Max, beat that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to have trouble following that. I'm probably more of a doomsayer and say that I reckon I probably had a bad attack of the yips when I was about 14, because I used to bowl leg spin and then suddenly couldn't bowl leg spin anymore. And I've not yet recovered. So now I'm a wicket keeper. So that would be my advice. Buy a pair of wicket keeping gloves.
Everybody's a wicket keeper these days. That's the problem, though. There's only one in the team.
Yeah, I hate wicket keeping. I'd rather quit. Max, do you want to quickly remind people where to find us and what they should do if they like the podcast? And then we'll have a quick break and move on to a review of the first test.
I'll give it a go. It's normally Ross's bit. So you can find us on Twitter at The Cricket Pod and on Instagram at The Cricket Pod, or you can email us at thecricketpod@gmail.com.
Excellent. And as ever, tell a friend if you like the show.
Hugh Jarvan, 6 for 9 at Cockermouth. That's Ben Stokes' old club, isn't it? Cockermouth. 6 for 9 at Future Cocker Cricket Club. Future Cocker Cricket Club.
Let's get right into the action from the last game then, because it was a fantastic match. Pakistan batted first and scored the highest score of the match, largely off the back of Shan Masood's 150. England sort of slightly failed with the bat and ended up 100 runs behind. And then Pakistan kind of doubled down on England's failure and didn't capitalise, which meant that with 2 days to play, England needed 277 to win. Which at the time I thought was probably out of reach, particularly after Saturday morning's antics from Yasser Shah with the bat. Anyway, things developed. England at one point were 100 for 5, which brought Butler and Wokes together for what I reckon for the pair of them is the batting performance of their careers. They took the game away from Pakistan, and England ultimately ended up winning. We'll get into the detail of that in a second. But Daniel, I'd like to ask you a question first. You were there, so what I'd sort of like to ask is, wasn't that a game that really deserved a full crowd? But particularly the climax.
Well, it would have been insane if there had been a full crowd, wouldn't it? I mean, the noise would have been beyond belief, because your summary was accurate, but it didn't quite convey the sheer magnitude of England's success at the end, because they had no right to win that game. They were essentially behind in that game from about 20 minutes after lunch on day two, when they decided to bowl Root and Bess in tandem for 5 overs up to the new ball, which wasn't in and of itself a ridiculous decision, but unfortunately they didn't bowl very well, and yeah. Shadab Khan batted absolutely brilliantly. And Sean Masood said to me, you know, that Shadab had said to him, right, they've got the two spinners on, let's attack. So by the time the new ball came, they were in a totally different frame of mind. And from that point, really, until England needed about 60 to win on the fourth day, England were behind throughout because they were having to play catch-up. We've seen on those pitches at Old Trafford, 326 batting first is a little bit above par. You know, 270, 280 is probably par. Then Pakistan bowled superbly with the first new ball to have England 12 for 3. And at that point, you kind of thought the game had gone even then. Some really important moments in it were Stuart Broad's cameo at the end of England's first innings, which just, you know, the difference between being 150 behind and being 107 behind is massively significant. Because you go out 150 behind, you sort of think, we've got to bowl the oppo out for 100 or under, don't you? You bowl up 107, you think, well, 150. And that doesn't sound quite as impossible, so you can get back in it. But England's body language looked a bit odd in that last session on the third day. You remember Chris Wokes could catch out the deep off Don Bess and just sort of rolled the back in. There was a sort of sense of...
They looked like they'd lost the game, or the game had gotten away from them.
That's exactly what they looked like, which is why you sort of... why the turnaround felt so extraordinary. And I think, really, it wasn't that they did think that they'd lost the game. It's that they were... the English mindset in those situations just seems to work a little bit differently. So they got quite focused, but quite silent. And then they were helped by some really poor bits of cricket from Pakistan as well, which people haven't touched on. You know, Asad Shafiq's run-out was insane. There was a freneticism to their batting. in that second innings, and especially in that last session when England took 7 wickets. And you didn't think that England bowled particularly well, but Pakistan did bat on occasions particularly badly. And then you mentioned the last innings. What was truly fascinating about that was that we'd been waiting for the pitch to do stuff because we knew it was dry and we knew it had cracks in it. And when it was bad, it was very, very bad, as Mae West would say. But when it was good, it was extraordinarily docile. And this was happening at one the same time. So after Shaheen Afridi bowled, you know, the ball of 2020 to get rid of poor old Ollie Pope, who had 2 terrific deliveries to get out to. But that second one was absolutely horrible. I mean, you have nightmares about that, just watching it, let alone playing it. When Wokes came in with Butler, something happened which was so brilliant about Test cricket. They both of them realised that there were no other options. In Test cricket, you've got so many options at any given time. Shall we play defensively? Shall we play attackingly? Shall we try and put pressure on the fielders with ones and twos? Wokes and Butler looked like they thought, oh, crikey, we've got to win this game in 35 overs or else we'll get out because there'll be enough balls there to do stuff to us. There's a new ball as well. So if they needed 60 or 70 with a new ball, they could have been blown away. So it utterly focused their minds. And it meant that they both of them played quite brilliantly and contrastingly brilliantly. You know, Butler's actually been playing quite well with the bat this season, but not quite getting the big score. Wokes has been abysmal. I mean, poor bloke. He had like 9 scores of 6 or under out of 10.
I think he averaged 7 at 5 going into Wednesday last week. Yeah,
I mean, it was horrible, and yeah.
That's not ideal when he's your last recognised batsman either, is it, in a slightly shortened lineup?
Well, we'd all given up. I mean, we absolutely gave up. 117 for 5, we gave up. But then,
well, do you think that's it? Do you think that's maybe partly the thing? The pressure's off at that point.
Yes, definitely.
And it just makes it so much... and without the crowd as well.
That's a really good question. It's hard to answer that counterfactual because you just can't be sure, can you? Mm. But what you do know is that they were out of options. There was one option. And I think that does give you a certain release, doesn't it? You know, when you go out and play your games, if you need 20 of 2 overs, you don't have the option to look for a single. You know, you've got to tee off. Similarly, Wokes suddenly found his timing. Like, I've never seen it before. The noise the ball made off his bat was just sumptuous. It was beautiful to watch. Now, as for the crowd, it's heartbreaking all year that we haven't had crowds because we've had some fantastic games of cricket. But, you know, when you're there watching it, it's quite a strange and eerie thing. We talked about a lot in the commentary box that are you allowed to go big with a 4 when there's no crowd there to sort of support you behind it, or do you feel like you sound like a bit of an idiot because you're just, you know, you're screaming into the ether, like, you know, like a football commentator, and there's nobody there. But actually, the game itself was so fantastic that you felt it. You sort of like, you didn't really need the crowd to feel it, and the players didn't either. The noise on the pitch was really fantastic in your headphones. You could hear them all shouting and screaming really into it. So, you know, I mean, it's a shame for the crowd, massive shame, that there wasn't a crowd. But in terms of the spectacle, the game was still brilliant.
Yeah, I was going to ask sort of a follow-up to the initial question is, what's it actually like in the bubble? Because we've been watching the cricket from TV. I think I had tickets for the West Indies at the Oval, but obviously there wasn't even any cricket at the Oval, so I wasn't there. What's the atmosphere in the bubble like? Is it as intense as it maybe looks on the TV? Because you can hear everything.
Well, that's a good question. I think with the working in the bubble isn't intense. It wears people down when they're in the bubble for a very long time. So some of my colleagues have been there for yonks. Poor old Ali Mitchell was in the bubble continuously from the first test against West Indies all the way through to the end of this one because there was no real gaps. And then she went to do the one day as down in the Aegeus. So she has basically been living out of a suitcase in a hotel with the same food and the same people. And you can't leave, you know, you can't get out of the ground. And she was in that for 30 days. And I think it wears you down. It wears the players down. Like, I spoke to Jason Holder at the end of the third test. And there's no doubt. I mean, they they put up with it really well, but there's no doubt that it took its toll psychologically, because with the best will in the world, Old Trafford is a perfectly lovely ground, but it's not like the Aegeus Bowl where you've got a golf course and you've got a great big, I mean, I hate golf, but that's not a good idea. You've got greenery and you've got trees and you've got other things to look at and you can go and walk around. Old Trafford, there isn't anything but a car park and the centre bit that you can play on and a couple of nets and a concrete perimeter. And you see the same people every day and you do the same things every day. So I think there's an intensity to the experience for the players, which is very, very wearing. And I think it showed for the West Indies by the end of the third test, because they'd also been in just like the one place for too long in a way. I think for us working in it, it depends on who you are, where you are. So Michael Vaughan doesn't live far away from Manchester. So I think it's quite difficult to think that your family is 2 miles away or three miles away or whatever, and you can't see them and everyone else is being set free and going to pubs and you can't. For me, I'd basically been in lockdown for 4 months. So getting to go and see people for the first time in yonks was absolutely heavenly. You know, it was joyful because I love my wife dearly. But 4 months with only one other person, you start, you know, it gets a little bit wearing. So there was a joy to it, but I don't want to minimize it. It's a very, very odd experience, brilliantly put together, incidentally, by ECB. You do get a lot of flack for a lot of things. But in this instance, they made it pretty comfortable and pretty easy. On the pitch, I don't know. I genuinely don't know the answer to whether the lack of a crowd reduce the intensity or not. I think to start with, it may have been a bit odd. I think when England played the first game at the Aegeus Bowl, there was a bit of feeling your way.
Yeah.
But then actually, look, the media scrutiny happens. People start writing articles, you know, writing people off, don't they? Because that's what the media does. They don't give anybody any breathing space. They don't point, you know. But we say when England go to Australia, well, no wonder they struggled in the first test. They've had no preparation. But no one was giving the players any of that leeway when they went into the first test and didn't perform brilliantly, but they've not played any first class cricket, you know.
Yeah.
They'd be stuck in their own bubbles for yonks. It's very difficult for them, but I don't know what you thought, but I thought the people who actually performed least well, and I mean this in the most generous way, the ones who actually needed most practice were the umpires. I thought the bowlers bowled really well. I thought the batsmen actually batted pretty well. I thought the umpires were the ones who could probably have done with some warm-up fixtures.
Yeah, I guess it's probably pretty tricky for them.
Yeah, it must be.
To just turn up and is it even possible to practice umpiring without
without
cricket going on? Yeah,
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, you could sit in front of the TV and go, you know, is that out or isn't it? And then, you know, find out that it was out. But I don't think it's not the same, is it? Yeah, you've got to be there, standing there.
It can't be the same experience. Yeah. Anyway, that gives us quite a good avenue to get back to the cricket. Talking about criticism there of players in the bubble, because a player going into this test match who was under quite a lot of pressure, I think, and I'll be honest, I'm not sure he should have been in the team, was Jos Buttler. And look at me now.
humble pie.
I think so, yeah. Does that for you to answer the Jos Buttler question?
Well, Max, why don't you go first? Because I've got very, very strong views on Jos Buttler.
Okay. Well, I look forward to those. I think we've all got quite strong views, actually, on this on this show. I think it maybe settles the question for Joe Root and the selection committee. It doesn't settle it for me because... And with a lot of credit to Jos Buttler for saying as much after the game... is that he felt he let England down with the gloves and, you know, had to put in that performance, and he did. And, you know, credit where credit's due, it was a fine performance and basically turned the game around. But you can also say, if he takes those chances in the first innings, we don't need his heroics. So, and primarily, I think a wicketkeeper should, you know, be there to do the wicketkeeping job.
Yeah.
And he hasn't necessarily...
Crickfiz actually had that down as the worst performance by a wicketkeeper in the last 3 years of Test cricket. So that might put that into context for you, Max.
I can understand why they might think that. And they were two really obviously bad mistakes, weren't they? And I mean, the stumping looks terrible as well because he just doesn't move. He's entirely statuesque and it thuds into his shoulder. I would point out that the ball did spit a bit. It did bounce a bit. And when I said that in the green room, I was attacked by everybody who thinks that Josh Butler shouldn't be keeping for England. And I take their point. But my view has always been with Josh Butler. It's partly that sport is entertainment and art and romance. And there will be a day when Josh Butler will score 200 runs in a day in Test cricket if you play him enough. A bit like, I know, monkeys and typewriters and Shakespeare, but the day that happens will be the greatest day you'll ever watch cricket. And I might be, you know, slightly...
I don't know, after Headingley.
Well, yeah, look, that was, yes, I get you. I take your point. It was brilliant. But if you were... No, you didn't need to be there to watch that partnership with Wokes and Butler to know what Butler can do and what his value to the team could be. And I strongly believe that Josh Butler could have been England's AB de Villiers. And for a whole number of reasons, I think it hasn't happened because there hasn't been a clarity of thought in the selection of him and what he was supposed to do and what his role was supposed to be. I've always thought that if he'd batted at five for England from the start of his career, he could have been absolutely fantastic. And people tell me that the stats don't lie. But wherever he's played, he started as a wicketkeeper. And I don't like this trend for really talented batsmen to have a second string to their bow being a wicketkeeper. I would like Ben Folkes to keep wicket because I think he's a brilliant wicketkeeper and an artist. And I think Josh Butler is a brilliant batsman and an artist.
So had we
started with him as a batsman, then I don't think we'd be having this conversation. The fact is we didn't. So I have to defend him to the hilt every time. Hmm. And it makes me look increasingly silly when he lets me down. He just doesn't score the runs I'd like him to score. But it's not a personal attack on me. But we wouldn't have had that game and that drama and that excitement and that finish if we hadn't had Josh Butler. And I just like to remind people just how brilliant it is when he does come off because it's worth the bits that don't go right. When it goes right, it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, so I'm somewhat conflicted. So I've been a big Josh Butler seller, if you like, over the last year probably. But I think so not just this Test match, one before, and like you were saying earlier, Daniel, he has actually batted quite well this summer and has put up the numbers that sort of reflect a player who is in form and is batting well.
Don't forget, as well. Batting at seven a lot of the time, which is quite a difficult place to do stuff from, especially if your tail isn't that hot, you know.
I don't know. I think England's tail is fairly reasonable to bat with, to be perfectly honest. So I probably hold that against him.
Would you want to bat with Stuart Broad? I mean, don't get me wrong. He's got some runs lately, but...
You've got the box seat for the most entertaining show in cricket.
I was going to say, I'd love to.
Yeah, but you don't go out there... If you're at number seven and you're on 74 and you're fighting for your place and Stuart comes out at number 10... He's got one way to bat, and it's to try to tonk the ball into over deep mid-wicket. And when it comes off, it's absolutely magnificent. But I remind you that when Matt Prior was scoring loads of runs at number seven, he had a Stuart Broad who had a really strong technique, and he had Graham Swan at number nine. So he actually had people who were proper batsmen coming in after.
Yeah, and I think if we're being honest as well, Matt Prior was a much better Test batsman than Josh Butler has developed into. I take the point around how he could have been England's AB de Villiers, but the reality is that he scored 140 Test matches.
I know, and it hurts.
And I'm happy, I think, for the near future at least, for Josh Butler to continue. Maybe not. It's hard. I mean, like, I'm not sure as the wicketkeeper. I also would like to see Folkes in the team. I'm happy for Josh Butler to continue in the side. But I think that comes with the slight caveat that we have to stop. And I'd include myself in this, and probably you, Max. Ross quite likes Butler, but I think we have to stop expecting him to be one day Josh Butler. I think we've probably got a guy who's going to score average 33 over the next 20 Test matches, batting at six or seven, which is okay. Lots of people can't do that. That's a reasonable Test career.
If you look at his best innings in Test cricket, they're actually proper Test innings. You know, out in Sri Lanka. He batted really, really well.
I think
better than anybody else. He swept brilliantly. His defensive technique is really good.
Yeah,
you know?
I think after Denley, he's the England player who's faced 100 balls most often in the last couple of years. So
that is correct.
I think that's true. There's something that's not quite right there, and I'm not sure it will ever be quite right. But Joss Butler not quite right, averaging 33 for the next couple of years. You're going to get innings like we got on Saturday. Who else are you going to pick? To some extent. I mean, there's not an obvious batsman who's going to average 45 in his place.
It's a very good... I mean, we know, don't we, that Stokes can't play in the last two games for unfortunate personal reasons, and we wish him all the best in that. But it does mean that the whole shape of England's side has to be the same shape that they've gone in the last couple of tests, with the assumption that Stokes, you know, Stokes couldn't bowl the last couple of tests, almost. He did bowl a little bit, but you know what I mean?
Yep.
So they've got to play six batsmen and they've got to find their bowlers from somewhere, their five bowlers, because they want to go in with five bowlers. That's how England have always been at their best. If that's the case, do you really put a different keeper in who hasn't played a first-class game for a year? I mean, I suppose you could airlift Johnny Bairstow into the bubble, but that seems highly unlikely. So if you play...
pass.
How do you do that? Yeah, and folks, I love... Ben Foulkes, and he's a very fine batsman. He had a terrible season last year for Surrey. So Butler is going to play the last two games. I mean, that's just the fact of it. So the kind of makeup of England's team, and Wokes, because of that, will have to play because he's the most capable batsman of the remaining seamers, as well as having played really well. So what you can read the runes of from this is that Butler will be six, Wokes will be seven, and then you've got to work out your 8, 9, 10, 11, which will be Stuart Broad, if he's fit, because they've belatedly realised that he's the best bowler in England. So it's funny how it takes so long to realise that he's the best bowler in England, even though he's got over 500 wickets. In any other country, they might have worked that out a little bit earlier.
took him literally complaining himself, didn't it?
Yeah.
Sort of did.
The final word of Sam Butler, his innings actually reminded you, does anyone remember Usman Khawaja's 100 against Pakistan, same opposition a couple of years ago? And I feel like it might leave England fans with the same feeling in the long run here that the Australian fans have with Khawaja, in that we will get flashes of brilliance like we saw on Saturday, but I don't think that we'll ever get the development of a great test player.
Well, I'm a romantic and I believe that this is going to kickstart a glorious final 15 years of Butler's career. And at the age of 45, he will retire with 15,000 runs to his name, and the last
before
15 years
becoming
will be brilliant.
Prime Minister of the UK.
I'd give him anything. I just think he's the most, I think he's a wonderful human being and a terrific player. But I do understand that I am not necessarily, that not everybody necessarily shares my view.
Diversity of opinion is a good thing.
I mean, if we've talked a lot there about Butler, you mentioned some the possible of a romantic late career blossoming in Test cricket is maybe revealing itself there. There's another player also, I think 30 or 31, playing for Pakistan who had their career moment, not necessarily stolen from them, but maybe usurped by Butler and Wokes. I'm of course talking about Shan Masood and his excellent 150. As an away batsman, Max, we'll start with you if you like. How did you rate that as an innings?
It was pretty impressive, wasn't it? He was struggling a little bit at the start. The ball was moving. England's openers were bowling pretty well on that first day. And he stuck in there and grafted. And once he got through that period, he was pretty impressive to watch. And I think it's all the more impressive when you consider that period he took out the game, rebuilding his technique after being dropped. And it's a real testament to dedication and hard work. I was really impressed.
It's also a great testament to Joss Butler, because without his drop, those would never have happened. I mean, if you want even more evidence of what he can do for world cricket, it couldn't be better illustrated. I happen to think that his innings was almost as scratchy as Rory Burns' 100 against Australia at Edgbaston last year, the one where Australians couldn't believe that he'd got to 100.
I'd absolutely love an innings like that.
I do, until he got to 100. And then he batted brilliantly. And I also think that it's very revealing that he was kickstarted by Shadab Khan, So when Shadab came in, he injected a completely different life force into that innings. You know, all the other batsmen were being very cagey, very test match. They were going at 2.5 and over. They were playing the first test match of a series, and they, you know, totally understandably, you were watching like really gritty, tough test cricket. And Shadab came in, and before lunch, he got 1 off 14 balls. And then after lunch, he flipped a switch and he played tip and run. And once he played tip and run, he got Shaun Massoud's legs moving. And that sounds really kind of ridiculous, but it did. It sort of got Shaun Massoud's brain into a more active space. And he started to trust his own shots and his own technique. And he started to try more things. And you saw a much different Shaun Massoud, thanks to Shadab Khan. And Shaun sort of actually gave Shadab credit for that as well. So, you know, it's a very interesting thing, isn't it, that players don't exist in the bubble of just their own performance. Look at how they're brought on. Like the Wokes-Butler partnership, it was a partnership. You know, Butler had been batting at that point with Jonathan Trott. Do you think that would have happened? I mean, I genuinely don't. You know, and that's no disrespect to Jonathan Trott, because Jonathan Trott plays a certain way, and he actually needed someone like Chris Wokes to come in and do that. Similarly, Shaun Massoud needed Shadab Khan to say, right, let's get after them, let's change the momentum, let's counterpunch. And that match, the whole of that match, was about punch and counterpunch. It was extraordinary. There were like long periods of nothingness happening, and then sudden bursts of major activity. And you can't really explain that to people who don't understand or like cricket, because if they pop in for the first time and they watch Sibley and Burns trying to start the second innings, they think, what the hell is this? What kind of a game is this? Why am I watching cricket?
What's he doing with his head?
What's he doing with his head? What's he doing with his head? And indeed his bat, for that matter. but, you know, there's a good reason for it. And then suddenly a switch is flicked, and it's not just the pitch, and it's not just the ball, and it's not just the atmospheric conditions. It's an attitude, and it's when a side sees another side and thinks, I'm gonna surprise you. And actually both sides did that to each other, and they didn't either side actually react very well to being punched. I mean, not surprising, neither do I, as it happens. So but you get my drift. I mean, that was one of the, I don't know whether it means we're going to see more aggression, because both sides have now got a bit of a muscle memory of how, if you attack, the other side struggles, you know. That'll be intriguing.
So we spoke about how England sort of looked a little bit listless on the end of the third day. I thought after lunch on the second day, I don't think I've ever seen Joe Root look less in control of the England cricket team when they were knocking the ball around and taking singles. They just didn't look like they had a plan. Did they throw the ball to Bess 9 overs into the second new ball? And Shadab did end up smacking the ball to mid-on, I think it was, and selflessly threw his wicket away for the sake of the game. but there was an hour-long period there where England didn't react, and then similarly at the end of the third day, and then for a lot of the Wokes, Butler,
but to a
passenger
degree,
play.
I mean, I think you've got to give credit to the Pakistani batsmen for how they arrested that initiative back, because, you know, it's not easy just to be in control, especially up to the second new ball. You know, that was a terrible passage of play, which was kind of self-inflicted, but it was the execution as much as the tactic, really. I mean, Bess bowled really poorly there, but no one was saying don't bowl Bess. They were saying obviously bowl Bess for 2 overs and bowl a seamer from the other end after the fact. But what Root was trying to do was hustle through 5 overs in 15 minutes, get the new ball and get on with the game, which is a legitimate tactic. It just didn't work. But then you've got to give credit to the Pakistanis for putting that pressure back on.
No, I agree. Well, it was only, in the scheme of the game, it was only 25 runs, I think. But it felt worse than that.
If there's a legitimate criticism, and I think it's a legitimate criticism, although, look, I don't know, even though I should know, shouldn't I? But we don't find these things out. If there's a problem with Chris Wokes, he's underbowled so much that you wonder if there's a sort of chronic injury there that prevents him from putting in the same amount of overs. But it was very confusing why he bowled as little as he did at various points in the match. When you watched him, you know, Jimmy Anderson, people criticised his bowling. His bowling actually, and CricViz, his model will tell you, his expected wicket average, if you believe in such things, was 24.7 in that game. And indeed in this summer, he hasn't got the breaks. You know, he's had catches dropped off him. He's had plays and misses. He's had catches fall short, that kind of thing. But Wokes has been unbelievably reliable and has picked up wickets when they've needed him to, and often in the first over of spells. And it was just a bit weird that he didn't bowl as much, which then makes you doubt your own judgment. So you think, there must be a problem with Wokes for him not to be bowling.
Yeah.
What do you say? I mean, you know, I don't know.
I'm not always convinced Joe Root keeps track of how much bowling he's allocating or how many overs he's allocating to different bowlers.
I think he probably does more now than he did. Because remember last year, we had the whole
Jofra. He did get a hammering for Archer, yeah.
For Archer, because he bowled him like 20 overs out of 25 from one end, which is a bit harsh. And then we wonder why his pace was down on the next game, you know, in a back-to-back test match.
Yeah. Right. We'll wrap up the first test and move on to the second test. The last thing I think we should do is apportion some blame. So where did it go wrong for Pakistan? I mean, my theory here is that is based on what a lot of the Pakistani pundits were saying, which is that Azhar Ali has a little bit of a history of letting those close games drift. Is he the one that made the mistakes, or has someone else done something wrong?
For me, there were two things, and they were happening in parallel. One of them was they were genuinely scared of Josh Butler. So when he came out, he hit Yazir for 2 fours through the covers. And you could see Azhar instantly move his field. As if, even though they were still miles ahead of the game, this was before the fifth wicket fell. So it was around about 116 for four, and then they got Pope out like the next over. As if they were just giving too much credit to Butler. Instantly, I mean, I give loads of credit to that. But when if I was playing against him, I wouldn't like to show that level of fear. But they did do that, and they also, they also left gaps for singles to get off strike. So Yazir, did he bowl a maiden? I think he didn't. While Butler and Wokes were at the crease,
I don't think so. Because didn't Butler keep reverse sweeping him whenever he got over 2 full? Yeah.
But you've got. There, I mean, that shouldn't happen in that situation. You've just got to hold your nerve, keep them in, and say to Butler, if you want to get these runs and you want to go quickly, you've got to go over the top. But in fact, there was a gap through backward point, there was a gap through square leg. He kept chasing the ball. When they did a bouncer barrage, they went for it really, really obviously. So they had Nazim Shah come round the wicket to Wokes, and they like signaled it. All right, so deep backward square, long leg, someone out there, guess what we're going to bowl? Short. Wokes moved outside leg stump and slapped him over the offside, at which point dear old Azhar like goes, oh, right, what do I do now? Change of plan, right? After one ball. Now, if you're batting and you see that your actions can create that much discombobulation in a captain's tactics, then that gives you a huge amount of confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And I think, and I would say, if you contrast, say, Owen Morgan in a one-day game with Azhar Ali in that test match, you see Owen Morgan and his bowlers can be hit for tens in four consecutive overs. His pace doesn't change, his plans don't change. His idea of what he's going to do is fixed in his own head, and he has confidence in what he's going to do. And Azhar communicated a degree of panic, which he acknowledged afterwards, actually. You know, Azhar Mahmood, who was on commentary with us, was vexed by Azhar's captaincy, but Azhar, in fairness, you know, put his hands up and said he didn't get it right. So I think it's a combination of aggressive, proactive, brilliant batting from Wokes and Butler, and Azhar responding to it reactively rather than just sticking to a course of action.
Yeah. Max, any thoughts?
I think I'll just leave the summary to the professionals, I think.
All right, just a quick reminder that you can find us on Twitter at The Cricket Pod, and tell a friend, let them know. We've got Dan Norcross on the show. That's excellent.
No.
So that's a pretty extensive summary of the first test there, and we'll move on to previewing the second test, which gets underway on Thursday the 13th, and we're back down to Southampton at the Aegeus Bowl, and it's lovely surrounds for the players. We touched on a couple of things earlier about the upcoming game. Mainly selection, I think, is the key thing to look at. So Ben Stokes is, as we said, sadly not going to be with the squad for the rest of the Pakistan series. And we've also lost Dan Lawrence, so that's probably going to have zero impact on England's selection, sadly for him. So I guess firstly, we are looking at the same makeup of side, so possibly quite a long tail again without our talismanic all-rounder. So who do we think is going to come in, really? I mean, is it going to be a simple Crawley for Stokes? Or could I put to you the suggestion, based on what we were discussing earlier, of Joss Butler at number five and Ben Folkes keeping? That's what I want to see.
I think Butler would go at six if he even did that, because Pope would go to five, because they're starting to get like real belief in Pope.
I was thinking Route 3, Pope 4. But...
Oh, were you? Okay. Route 3, Pope 4.
That's extravagant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Butler 5. So Wokes, Maverick. Wokes 6, Folkes 7, and then your four bowlers. Not entirely inconceivable. I think it's unlikely, because I think Root doesn't like batting at 3. We know that. And he really doesn't like batting at 3. And you can have all the tired old arguments and say, well, he should just do it, and he's England's best batsman, and blah, 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 blah. But he's got quite a lot on his plate because he's captain, and it is quite a difficult job, and it does take its toll. So I think letting the captain bat where he wants to isn't the worst idea. And so Zach Crawley, who's had some quite encouraging moments in an England shirt and is young, will come in. So they'll do that. I mean, because that's what they do. They basically do sort of what you expect them to do most of the time. Then you've got to ask yourself, right, so you've got Root 4, Pope 5, Butler 6, Wokes 7. That's absolutely definite. Broad at 10, except in a run chase. So who's 8, 9 and 11? And I think that is very, very much open to question. It could be any sort of combination, because they've talked a lot about rotation. And they meant it as well at the start of the season. They really did mean that they wanted to rotate. I thought that this was going to be another year of pretending to rotate, but not really rotating and just waiting for someone to get injured, because that's how rotation normally works.
When you've got six tests in 8 weeks, I think.
Correct. I feel like they tried rotation, annoyed the best bowler, lost, and now they're not going to rotate anymore. That the experiment's over.
That is sort of my feeling too. But then... okay, so the Anderson is the elephant in the room here, right?
Yes.
So Anderson, does he play at the Aegeus Bowl? Well, if you're basing his performances on his last two games at Old Trafford, there's two things to remember. Firstly, that he didn't bowl that badly at all and actually would have kept things tight and would have taken wickets if people had taken catches that should have done.
Yeah, including, I definitely agree with that.
Including Ben Stokes, who, incidentally, my controversial opinion of Ben Stokes is that he is a taker of great catches, but not a great catcher. He drops an awful lot of regulation two-handed catches at second slip, but he does take some absolutely blinding brilliant catches. So
it also seems like he kind of goes for everything in the slips. You know, he wants to do everything, and sometimes maybe leave it to the man that it's flying straight at rather than.
I mean, you say that if he was in my team, that'd be perfect, because I stand at first slip, so I could blame the wicketkeeper or the second slip for screwing it up for me. But yes
I stand at first slip, knowing the ball will never go to first slip, just because I want to talk.
Me too. Yeah. And also don't want to walk or run at any point.
It's got a lot of positive attributes, first slip, hasn't it?
It's the best position on the field.
Anyway, James Anderson.
Yeah. So James Anderson, I don't think that he is actually bowling worse than normally. And I think he did actually bowl quite well at the Aegeus Bowl, where I think he's slightly happier than Old Trafford. His record at Old Trafford isn't fantastic. So you might think that they would continue with him. There seems to be a strange buzzing noise here, but that must be me. So you'd think that they might continue with him, but an alternative would be, and it's quite a weird and wacky one, where do Wood and Curran fit into this? Because every time Curran plays, it works, and they've got a batting problem.
I'm sort of fully expecting them to play Curran because of the batting.
I think so, and it doesn't do them any harm, because if they insist on playing a off spinner to a bunch of right-handers, which they've shown no sign of changing throughout the season, even though obviously playing your premier spinner, the one who's most liked by Somerset and who gets in the team ahead of Best and turns the ball away from 10 West Indian right-handers and 9 Pakistani right-handers, but they seem not to want to do that for some reason.
But again,
might as well
batting,
have a left armer who is going to make rough, the same rough that Shaheen Shah Afridi will make, be your off spinner to bowl into.
Makes sense. But are we also locked into Bess as well with the batting again? You know, Leach isn't gonna score many runs for you. He'll dig in. He'll be good to bat with Joss Butler. But
it's a very good question. And then you have the thorny issue of Archer as well, because the Archer conundrum is one largely of our own making.
Are we allowed to say that he's not bowling very well?
If he weren't bowling very well, we would be able to. Like, he bowled a spell in that match.
He's bowling inconsistently, maybe.
1 for 7, which was fantastic. Yeah.
But is he in there to be a consistent hold up and end bowler, or is he in there to go and have a 5-over spell of brilliance?
I think you want him to be a bowler who goes in there and bowls 5 overs of brilliance, but unfortunately, I don't think you can just turn it on like that. You know, I think fast bowlers have rhythm on their day and they feel like they're going to bowl. You know, even Jeff Thompson and Dennis Lilly bowled 90 miles an hour one day and 85 miles an hour the next day. Michael Holding was exactly the same. So
yeah, and he's, you know, always on Sky got a lot to say about that, and always very supportive of Archer and talking about that rhythm. And I will definitely defer to him when it comes to talking about fast bowling.
And Mark Wood's average in England is not great, so I don't think that there's a right answer to it. What happens is they pick a bunch of bowlers that are, all of them, very good. We're very lucky. I mean, it's not like when I was watching cricket in 1989 and we had to have Phil Newport opening the bowling against Mark Taylor and David Boone or something like that. And it was an absolute bloody nightmare. And they'd be on 300 for none by the close of play. So, you know, essentially what you're talking about is marginal differences between Wood, Archer, Anderson, Curran, which of those you're going to put in. I think the structural question of playing an off spinner or a left arm spinner is a different one. And not because I don't think Dominic Best is a very good cricketer, but, and I think he will over time become a very good cricketer, but I don't understand why they persist in bowling off spinners. And it's not just numbers, it's just fact. You know, you look at Graham Swann against right-handers and left-handers, it's not just go and get cricketers to give me the figures. Everybody knows that the ball turning into a right-hander is going to be easier than the ball going away from the right-hander. It's just is what it is. It has been forever and a day. So I don't quite know why that's happening. If it's not just because they think there's the marginal gain of Bess averaging 19 and Leach might average 10, which over the course of 2 innings is 18 runs.
But, yeah. I agree with that. I like Bess as well, and I think he adds a little bit of balance to the team, particularly if you go with Anderson, Broad, Archer. I think then there's quite a compelling case to have him in as your number 8. But then if you swap out Anderson, say, for Curran, then I think you lose the gain in many ways, because he's going to be batting slightly lower, which means that even if he's not out, you're not going to get the full benefit of the person who can bat. Probably Broad will do something stupid, and then we've seen Archer and Anderson. I don't know. I wouldn't call them batsmen if we were going to be polite about it. So I think you sort of lose something there. I also rate Leach. I think Leach has bowled to some quite good teams and on some quite flat decks. So I think he's maybe a slightly better bowler than his figures so far. Although I'm sure England have got data on that maybe indicates that he isn't. So perhaps I'll put myself into a corner there.
I just think about the footmarks that are going to be created by Shaheen Shah Afridi. If he comes in left arm over the wicket, he's going to create footmarks around the right-hander's off stump.
Yeah.
Then if you're Leach, that's great. If you're Bess, it's not so great unless they're going to spit and bounce.
Yeah.
So you can get them caught in the leg trap. Whereas, you know, coming in round and then into those duck marks and spitting away, much more fun. Now, again, I mean, the Aegeus Bowl, Moeen Ali had a great game at Aegeus Bowl, so maybe Ospin has worked, but he was also bowling at more left-handers when he did do that. I don't really know. I think we're going to peer through the fog, and what they're going to tell us is that whoever is left out has been rotated, because it's the nicer thing to say. And they're going to say, you know, all these games are coming thick and fast. And there'll be truth in it too, because they are coming thick and fast. And it isn't going to be easy for Archer, Anderson and Broad. Like, we're all assuming that Broad's going to play, and you'd expect him to because he's bowling better than anyone else at the moment. But he will have had to play four games back to back at his age. And no one's talking about the fact that he's 34 and what that'll do to him. We're just going, oh, we were wrong about him. Put him in, make him play. Force him out there. I genuinely don't know. My gut feeling is that Broad will play, and my gut feeling is that Bess will play, because I think they're stubborn and they want to continue with that. Yes. And so that then leaves you with Archer, Anderson, Curran and Wood, and you're going to perm two of those. My gut feeling is that Wood won't play. I think if England go 2-0 up, they'll play him in the last game. That would be my gut feeling. And my gut feeling is that Anderson will play. So it's then about Archer or Curran. And I don't think they'll want to go into that game because they don't have Stokes. And remember, you know, Stokes hardly bowled in that last game. But when he did that, suddenly get something out of the pitch roll. That
the Neil Wagner.
Neil Wagner, the most confusing cricketer in the world.
I'm convinced that's what Stokes is trying to do for England, is the long spells of quite hostile short pitch bowling. Not necessarily extreme paced, but uncomfortable batting.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think you're absolutely right. And they don't have, I don't think, you know, Sam Curran isn't going to make you feel awkward.
No.
Whereas Archer or Wood will. But I think they will stick. I think they will stick with basically the same team, the same bowlers. Yeah.
I think it sums it up really, doesn't it? We don't really know, and whatever we suggest is going to happen will probably be the exact opposite.
And I should know, shouldn't I?
You can't guess.
You know, I should know because I'm sort of there. But honestly, I'm not just
talk about these things in front of you?
Well, that's the thing. You sit around with all these pundits, and we do talk about all these things, and we don't actually know until like 15 minutes before the play. So Aggers will do an interview. Or he'll start the programme on the first day, as he did this time. And Michael Vaughan was saying, well, I wonder if this will happen, that'll happen. And Aggers would say, well, I think it won't. I think this will happen, that'll happen. And Vaughan would say, well,
that's quite encouraging. Sounds like we're touching on how they do it in the pros. So.
But then Aggers will say, no, Michael, what I meant to say is, I've been told what's going to happen. And I've only just been told. Yeah. I've only just been told. So we do genuinely not know. Until, I mean, like, you know, the first game, there was an absolute assumption against the West Indies that England, if they won the toss, would bowl.
Yeah.
And we thought we knew what the team was as well. And it wasn't the team we thought it was, and they batted. So the idea that we are privy to some kind of special information is not true. And it's a good thing. I would say it's a really good thing, because I hate it when teams announce their side the night before. I think it's ridiculous. I think it gives an unfair advantage. Well, unfair. It gives a stupid advantage to the opposition, and you should keep everyone guessing. And the moment you let any of us know what's going on, we'll blurt it out. So they're very sensibly, very sensibly don't let us in on it.
So is there anything about James Anderson that people have let you know that you would blurt out? Are people being a little bit harsh? Should we be leaving James Anderson to make his own decision, England's best bowler for
years? I'll tell you what I do know about James Anderson, which is what he's told me. And I had the most revealing and interesting conversation with him, and I've told people this before, so it's not a scoop for you, but it's it's moderately intriguing. So when he was commentating for us in the One Day International Series after the Ashes in 2017-18, he was quite grumpy when he first met us about...
Sound like him.
No, it doesn't, does it? As he said... I said, you're a bit grumpy. He said, well, you guys just keep on going on about how old I am. And I said, well, come on, Jimmy. I mean, the reason why we keep on talking about who's going to come after you is that, like, you're not going to It's like, you're not going to keep going forever. I mean, you're not going to like come back here, are you? You're not going to come back to Australia in 40 degree heat to bowl on these piss poor wickets with a kookaburra ball and go through the agony of all that again. And he said, why? Why would you think that? I said, well, because no sane human being would do that. No, I don't want my last memory of playing in Australia to be losing 4-0. In his mind, and he also said, you know, that when he'd been netting, he'd found two, like he'd tend to a bit of Shane Warne, to be fair. He said, I found a new ball that I could bowl that I'm really enjoying. I'm really loving bowling in the nets. And you know, you can believe that or not. I do believe it, as it happens. His passion for the game and his desire to keep on playing is truly extraordinary. And he meant it. He was genuinely irritated with us writing him off for age in the same way that Stuart was the other day when he did the same thing. So my expectation is that Jimmy will continue to play until not his arm falls off, but it is when he gets an injury that he feels he can't perform at his own level. That's when that will happen. So
yeah,
you won't see the back of him until that happens, basically. I wouldn't be massively surprised if he played in the next Home Ashes series in 3 years' time. I know that sounds utterly mad, but that wouldn't be beyond him. He loves playing cricket, and he likes doing that more than he likes being behind the microphone with us, which he's very, very good at. But he still wants to keep playing. So
yeah, I think that's a good place to leave a preview of the second test. That obviously starts on Thursday, which is the 13th, as we record on the Tuesday. I'm excited for that, and we will cover that in our next podcast. We'll take another quick break, and then we have a couple of questions for Daniel. But I think he has to leave fairly soon after that, so it'll only be a couple.
It was 335 to win for India, and then came the near unbelievable part. Sunil Gavaskar batted through 60 overs and made 36 not out. I've never seen anything quite like it in a limited overs game before or since that day. It was almost as though they were having batting practice, either that or playing for a draw. England won the match by 202 runs.
So we've looked at the England-Pakistan Test Series, and thank you again to Daniel Norcross for coming on and helping us with that, with some better insight than you might be used to.
But it would. What are you saying about Ross?
Well, I'll tell him later. But it would be remiss of us to get Daniel on and not ask him a few questions about some other bits. So the first thing that I wanted to ask. Which was something that I came across, which I don't know whether it's true or not, so we'll find out. It's sort of about the journey into commentary and Test Match Special. It's a slightly less well-trodden path than those taken by some of your colleagues, of Messrs Agnew and Swan and Vaughan, etc. A bit dreamy, really. But apparently also along the way you had a job that involved playing pub quiz machines. If that's true, how did that come about? What was it like? And, of course, do you have any tips?
Okay, well, job is an extraordinary way of describing it. Like, you know, I didn't apply to pubmachinestealer.com, you know. No, what happened was, when I was at university, I studied classics, which is a ridiculous subject to study unless you just are interested in blood and gore and Romans and Greeks, which I was, as it happened. Not really how they spoke it, which was a bit of a downfall when it came to my finals, but, you know, the actual sort of Latin and Greek bit was a bit tricky, but, you know, the stories were great. So, at the university I was at, you had one tutorial a week, basically, and lectures were optional. So you're sort of doing 1 to 2 hours work a week. So I'd spent quite a lot of time in my local pub. And as a student in 1989, 1991, you didn't have a lot of money. I mean, you don't ever as a student. I mean, luckily we didn't have loans, but we didn't have any money. So I thought, there's a quiz machine. And I'd like, you know, fairly good on trivia because I watched an awful lot of telly and an awful lot of sport. And my uncle's an actor, so I watched an awful lot of films. And pub quiz machines are basically trivia history, sport, and films. So I put a pound in, and I lost it, but it took about half an hour. And I thought, hello, this is quite good, because it's A, B, and C, you know. So I put another pound in, got a friend involved, and so we pulled a bit of knowledge. And within about 2 days, we'd realised, because it was 1990, you know, that they were still operating on those computers that sent people to the moon, you know, ones that have got like half a K.
Yeah.
So they only had about 500 questions in their armour. Okay. And it turned out that I knew half of the answers, and I had an educated guess for the remaining half of the other half, so a quarter. And then he got a 1 in 3 chance of getting it right. So when he got it right, I've got quite a good memory. I remembered it. I'm a cricket fan, so yeah, essentially slightly troubled on the brain front. So within about 2 days, I knew the answer to every single question in this quiz machine. And then a friend of mine who I did it with, who currently works at the BBC in a very senior position on their news department, but I will not divulge his name. And we saw there was a telephone number attached to the side of this quiz machine, and it said, I can see it now, clear as that. I can even remember the first 5 digits because that's how troubled I am. Claremont Leisure 01947, and then 4 digits. So my mate rang and said, hello. We're calling from ISIS magazine in Oxford, and we'd like to do a feature on the most popular quiz machines in pubs, because quiz machines were huge in the late 80s, early 90s. It was like the version of, like, you know, a fruit machine. It's only got more people involved. And brilliantly, people who didn't have a capacity for remembering things just kept on piling money into it and forgetting and being pissed and then putting the same wrong answer in the next day. It's great. So I said, we'd like to do a feature on your machine, Skill Cash, because it's come second in a survey that we've done of most popular quiz machines. And this woman at the other end of the phone was marvellous. She said, oh, okay. Where would you like to where would you like to know where they are? I said, well, sort of ideally within a 5 mile radius of my postcode, right? My postcode, SW17 2. So she then just handed over to us the name of 20 pubs that had this machine in it. And if you can imagine what it's like being a 22-year-old man, knowing that all you've got to do is to walk into a pub, instead of getting a job, walk into a pub, put a pound into a box, and over the course of 20 minutes, steal all the money that's in it, and then walk out again. And, yeah, I mean, it was a job. I mean, I've never been better paid in my life in real terms.
Probably right, through the roof.
Well, I had housing benefit, I had the dole, and I had about, I don't know, but it would have been about 250 quid in cash every week in 1992.
Pound coins.
In pound coins, yep. It bought a lot of bottles of Pinot Noir in the local spa at £2.99 a bottle at the time. So yes, it was one of the happiest times of my life. And then unfortunately, computer programming and computer power and capacity increased as the wider intelligence of humanity screwed my chances of spending my life just filching off quiz machines forever. But yeah, it was, if you want to call it a job, it was a job.
That it's certainly impressive. Like me and Max, or Max and I, when we were at university, they're in all pubs now, a quiz machine, and we worked out the Colour of Money mega game. If you put a pound in instead of 50p, it removed the hardest of the 3 attainable goals you could reach, and it gave you an extra life, so you got an extra guess. And you didn't actually have to get that many questions right to start taking money out of it. We went to university in 2010-11, Max, is that right? So I think computer technology had maybe got to the point where it realised you were taking it for a ride by then, because after we realised, we started taking money out of it, the machine shut down and never worked again.
I mean, it's devastating when that happens. I mean, honestly, I'll tell you, just a little coda to this story is that where I was, there was a guy who had come second in Mastermind, and he and a few other people used to do the same thing with the quiz machine. and I became part of their set. We never spoke, right? But if you saw one of us coming out of the pub, there was like a little nod. And we developed a kind of calling system. So if you'd just taken a machine for all the money that was in it, you lit a cigarette and you put it filter side down on the top of the machine and you let it burn all the way down so that when you walked into that pub, you knew not to waste your time. That, my friends, is socialism and community.
that is a better answer than I could possibly ever have hoped for from that question.
Yeah, that is fantastic. following on from that, and I guess moving towards your broadcast career now, you set up Test Match Sofa. How did you come up with that idea? Why did you come up with that idea? I think it's probably a better question than how, because I think we can piece that together. Yeah.
How is really boring. I mean, how is like knowing people and getting people to do things for no money. That was off the bat.
We're learning.
Well, actually, I mean, there is a sort of how to the why, really. I used to be an IT project manager in the city. It was a job that I wasn't very good at. And the only bits I enjoyed were the people I worked with. The actual mechanics of the job I detested because I didn't really understand. I didn't understand what a pension plan was. I didn't know why I was setting up these platforms. I didn't know what a platform was. But, you know, you would do that for money because you needed it. And when I was made redundant the second time, or third probably, I think it was the third time, in 2008, the big crash of 2008, and this is the why, I had missed the previous Ashes series in 2005 because I was working as a project manager and I had to keep on going to these pubs and pretend I was at meetings if I was going to watch any of that great series, you know, and like filling out calendars with erroneous meetings and things like that. So people thought I was actually working, but I wasn't. It was hellish. And I vowed to myself when I was made redundant that I would try to tell my now wife that there was a reason for not working through the Ashes summer of 2009. Now, as it happened, I mean, that series, though good, was nowhere near as good as 2005. But what I sort of worked out was that people couldn't listen to Test Match Special abroad. And I consider it, you know, that other people consider fundamental human rights like, you know, equality and the reasonable distribution of wealth and that our politicians care for us. And I agree with all of that. But really, the most fundamental human right is that if a Test Match is taking place, you must be able to hear it wherever you are in any part of the world. And when that's not happening, we as a human race are diminished terribly. So I set about becoming the sort of Jesus Christ, the Lord Saviour of the wider diaspora of cricket listeners. And I thought, you know, I'd get an OBE for this. And it turned out I wouldn't. I'd just get an awful lot of really angry letters from lawyers for about 4 years and broadly speaking, unpleasant articles written about me in newspapers. But it seemed like a nice idea at the time. So the idea was that I could reach out to everybody around the world and they would know what was happening in the cricket, regardless of whether they were geo-blocked for this reason or there were rights issues for that reason. I hate all that. I hate the whole business of business.
Yeah.
And I think that business gets in the way of democratization and availability and growing the game. And I think we fixate so much on making money and we don't fixate enough on building a fan base and people to love this extraordinary game, because cricket is a ludicrous game, and everybody in cricket knows it's ludicrous, but when you get the bug, you're done for life. So I felt it was my job to go and infect the rest of the world with the cricket bug, and I don't think I succeeded, but I've ended up with quite a nice later life career out of it. So that's the story of the how and the why, really. And I mean, the how was that I've played a lot of amateur cricket like you guys do, you know, so I knew a lot of people who loved their cricket, and I've always believed that people who genuinely love cricket can talk about cricket cogently. You don't have to be a former player to be able to speak entertainingly about the game. So I was always strangely confident that if you gave me and my mates a microphone, we'd be able to describe the action to you while you're teaching English as a foreign language in Chiang Mai and you can't get hold of the cricket. And that was essentially what it was. And it turned out I wasn't totally wrong. I mean, sometimes we were an incoherent mess.
So
sometimes we weren't.
If we take, so you might not have been spot on at that moment with your assessment of the future. If you're going to make a similar assessment now, where do you think the game is going more broadly? And I think maybe in your particular area, where do you think cricket media is heading?
I think cricket media has actually never been stronger. I think that when I was a kid, I was brought up with a kind of conservative with a small c. I mean, a lot of the writers were not politically conservative, but there was a sense that a cricket report began with the sun glinted through the yew trees at the Statham End and illuminated a scene of pastoral glory as these fine men did battle and blah-de-blah-de-blah. And it was sewn up. No, I say sewn up. It wasn't sewn up. It's not fair. There were a lot of writers on newspapers providing an awful lot of really good coverage, but they talked a lot in terms that sort of kept the viewer and the listener and the reader as a remove from the actual action. And I think now we've got this wonderful plurality of opinion and thought. You've got the older writers who can be superb, like Shield, Berry, you know, a great writer, Paul Edwards on Crick Info. Then at the same time, you've got these, you know, you've got Crick Viz, you've got Freddie Wilde and Ben Jones, you've got people bringing in an entirely different way of looking at how it's done. You've got random Aravis like Jared Kimber, who actually started really, I mean, started by writing a blog and then was on Test Match Sofa with me at the beginning. You've got a comedian, Andy Zaltzman, who's a statistician now on TMS, who also started on Test Match Sofa doing cricket, really, although he wrote a bit for Crick Info. So you've got women galore. Like we talked about a little bit about Annie Mitchell in 2006-07 and Donna Simmons before that, but now just the awareness of the woman's voice in cricket, Ali and Isha and Ebony and Mel Jones and Lisa Stalaker, and you know, it just, it's so promising. It's so exciting to hear so many different people from so many different backgrounds having a platform to talk where they never did before.
Do you think that is maybe slightly reflective of the game in England rather than the global game, though?
No, I think like in Australia.
So, I mean, maybe the English-speaking world or maybe even just the big three. I think what I'm getting at here is cricket media strong in all 12 of the full ICC members, are we projecting what's developed here onto some other places?
That's a good question. But, you know, I mean, you've got to be excited by the fact that Channel 9 a couple of years ago rolled out a whole team of white men, and the only thing that was different between them was that one of them was wearing a hat. And within 2 years, you've got Ali Mitchell fronting Channel 7. You've got Mel Jones. You've got Lisa. You've got Isha. You've got, like, the whole landscape of broadcasting has massively changed. In Australia, it's suddenly like that. In India, which is quite a conservative environment in many ways, they made the conscious decision to bring Lisa and Mel and Isha and Anjan Chopra into IPL coverage, which has changed the way it's worked in the biggest, most popular state in the cricket world. And it's brought, you know, I know families and women, it all sounds like terribly sort of woke and PC, but it's hugely important. You know, cricket cannot be the preserve of white middle-class public school boys, or else it dies. Because that's, you know, just look at every other sport that actually thrives. It can't work like that. So you're right to ask the question, what's happening in South Africa? What happens in South Africa is Cass Naidu, Natalie Jamanos, Makaya Rantini. You know, there's a diversity of voices there, as well as Sean Pollock, you know, and others, Pommy and Bangwa and Robin Jackman before that. I think Sri Lanka perhaps could do with getting a little bit more on with it, but Sri Lanka hasn't got, you know, their board hasn't got an awful lot of money. There's not an awful lot of money in cricket there. So, yes, there are areas, massive areas for improvement all over the world, but the direction of travel is the right direction of travel, isn't it? Don't you think? I mean, what's happening in New Zealand as well. And I love that. And I love what social media does for it. I love what the internet does for it. I think that being able to get clips of stuff out, there are, however, big, big problems. So rights issues. I am infuriated by the idea that cricket that has been played in the past is suddenly, you know, like Rob Moody, Rob Alinda on
oh cricket. Yeah, I think multiple guests we've had this chat with about right. the delisting of his videos.
Yeah, so you'll know exactly what I mean. I mean, that we have got to just stop this nonsense, you know. What happened in the past is how you bring people in.
So
in the
what
future.
If people want to watch 100 David Boone cover drives?
Yeah, well, exactly.
Why does that need to be protected?
If that's what gives people the horn on cricket, then get them in, as far as I'm concerned. Because what you've got to do is get them excited and get them involved. And I know there is another argument, which is about protecting rights, because they spend an awful lot of money, companies spend an awful lot of money on buying rights. But they're really buying rights for the now. They're buying rights for the advertising revenue they get from live cricket and for the bit around that season. It doesn't make any bloody difference. A clip from 2001, that should just be made available to the general public. If we had a sense of really caring about the sport, then we would disseminate it far and wide. But mercifully, because the internet is a bit of the Wild West, it does get disseminated anyway, regardless of what these pompous buffoons attempt to stop.
I mean, even from last year, has anyone seen highlights of a game that wasn't Headingley or the World Cup final?
I think if you're in New Zealand, you're probably...
Does anyone know where the tapes are for the rest of those games?
Well, you know, Jay, you make a good point, because 30 years ago, they would have been videotapes, and now they'd have been worn out, so you wouldn't be able to see them. But yeah, look, I mean, that would be my biggest concern, is that we still faff about with that nonsense. And the other big concern, and you would have talked about this before, I've no doubt, is that the ICC needs to protect cricket, because you cannot expect the English Cricket Board and Cricket Australia and the BCCI to be generous to other countries. They're not set up to do that. It's not in their DNA to do it. They may make generous gestures every now and then, but that's not their raison d'etre. So the purpose of having the ICC is there to ensure that we still have competition and we still grow the game and we make it thrive. And one of the things I would love to see happening is the ICC take some of the enormous amount of money it gets from TV rights and give it to countries to subsidise their test match contracts. So South Africa, for example, players would not feel the need to go and play county cricket for £100,000 a year, because South African Cricket Board would be able to pay them £100,000 a year, because they were being helped by the ICC. We need to do that. As a game, we need to, the top of the game needs to be collectively much wiser.
No, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think paying the top 200 players in the world £80,000 a year is something that you could do with the spare change left over from the IPL. It's not...
Good. Well, I'll tell you another thing you can do. and it's paying them a lot less, is if you want to grow the game in associate cricket, is you create a bursary for every single first-class country, county, stroke island, stroke entity, you know, Tasmania, Leicestershire, the Leeward Islands, whatever you want to call it. And you give them a £30,000 or £40,000 bursary to pick and play. They don't have to play them, somebody from an associate nation. So Nepalese players get to play in the first-class system around the world. Not just Nepalese, obviously, Dutch, whatever. And by doing that, they get to play proper first-class cricket with proper coaches. And then when we come to have the arguments about how the World Cup should be, instead of whining about it being a reduction to 12 teams, what we've actually watched is a really good qualifying tournament with really good players. And that's part of the World Cup. And then when you get to the main tournament, you might actually still only have 12 teams, but that have got there on merit against, because good players have been playing games to qualify to do that. That would be really simple things you can do to grow the game with the enormous pot of cash that the ICC has.
Yeah, there's a lot that can be done, and the ICC have got, well, yeah, they should probably be supporting the smaller nations more. I don't think there's any secret to that. And hopefully we'll see something change in that respect soon. But sadly, I'm not holding out too much hope. But in terms of cricket governance, one body that, is certainly much maligned by us and some others often is the ECB. And I would like to give them some credit on this occasion for what I think is quite a good idea in the Bob Willis Trophy. Getting county championship going in this global pandemic situation has been quite impressive, and I actually think it's a really good idea. Having sort of that showpiece final at Lord's is really, really good for the Red Bull game, especially with all the conversations that go on about whether it's the pinnacle or not, and getting players to play in that format. It's a little disappointing that they've kind of ruined that by sort of having only the top two from all the groups go and play it, and just saying, "Oh, you won your group, but tough." That's a shame. But ultimately,
there's a lack of time there, Max, isn't there?
Yeah,
I mean, I think what they've done is incredible by coming up with that and organising it and sorting it out. Look, one thing we've got to be very clear on is it's not the county championship, because Somerset are going to win it. And it'll be the funniest
thing.
Surrey
definitely aren't. We know that much.
Well, Surrey definitely aren't. Yeah, in fairness to Surrey, they've got about 8 players currently.
Yeah, missing.
Big old bubbles.
Yeah. Sussex have done too.
Yes. But no, you're absolutely right. I think they've done a great job to get, and they didn't need to. I mean, if the ECB was as obsessed with money as people keep on saying they are, then they wouldn't have bothered putting on behind closed doors 4-day Red Bull matches around the country. So that is a duty of care to the players, because they need to make sure they don't have an entire season lost through COVID. And it keeps us, I said to you earlier, I've sat outside in the garden listening to the commentaries, and it felt as real as a county championship. The difference being that when Somerset do win, it'll have a big asterisk next to it, and it won't be the county championship. And
it's the Bob Willis Trophy.
It's the Bob Willis Trophy, which is a great trophy to win. It's a magnificent trophy to win, but it's not the county championship, let's be absolutely clear. And I think a Lord's final is brilliant. I don't know whether you guys think that is the way to go long term. I do think that two divisions of 9 worked great with 16 games.
Yeah.
I don't like this reduction to 14 games, which sort of destroys the integrity of the first division. And in the future, I'd just like to see 2 divisions of 9, but that's my personal preference. Maybe I'm a miserable old git. I do quite like the idea of a Lord's final at the end of it.
Well, that's what I was sort of going to ask, actually. The Lord's showpiece, I think, is a really good idea. And I was gonna put it to you whether you think that might be the potential route to go down in the future for the county championship. And yeah, I also agree that the remodelling seems slightly bizarre. But
well, I get quite a good chance of getting picked for a 5-day final, so that's 5 days of extra work. So obviously, I'm likely to put it. So I'm just putting it out there so that you understand where my feelings come from. But in all seriousness, I wouldn't like the county champions to have finished second 48 points behind the leaders. But I do quite like the way they do it in rugby league. So I quite like the idea that you'd crown the county champions and then you'd have a final.
Like a
grand final, exactly.
Yeah.
And get a double. I think I'd quite like that. But like I say, I think I've always thought that there was a problem with the Sheffield Shield final, and that it was perhaps the worst game of first class cricket ever played each year in Australia was a Sheffield Shield final, because whoever was top won the title if they drew. So, they would bat unbelievably slowly and get 512 all out in 2.5 days.
That's a scheduling oversight, I think.
So you've got to be careful what you wish for, because cricket, the way cricket works is just that's the way the game is. It encourages evil.
There's also a risk it might end up getting played at the end of October as well, which wouldn't be ideal.
There's also that, but I think this year it'll be brilliant. I think a Lord's final will be absolutely brilliant. And I've got to say that one of the most thrilling days of county cricket I've ever witnessed was the year Middlesex. I'm a Surrey fan. Middlesex won the county championship against Yorkshire with that hat trick from Roland Jones to win it. And there were about 15,000 people in the ground.
Yeah.
And there were queues coming in at tea on that last day, beautiful sunny day. And it just reminds you that for all the jokes we make about COVID and county cricket's the perfect place to be socially isolated. There's like 1 million people listening in on the radio, and when it gets really exciting, they come pouring in because it's unbelievably loved. So, you know, I mean, that's what got me into cricket. I don't know what got you into cricket, but it was the thing that got me into cricket. I'm a Surrey fan before I'm an England fan, like a lot of lunatic cricket fans who care more about Northamptonshire and can't understand why Ben Sanderson isn't playing for England. Is he still playing for Northampton? I don't know. But you know, I think it's a beautiful thing, and I'm going to really enjoy it this year. And I will use my pass to get into Lords for that final, come what may.
So Daniel, we'll wrap up. There's one last question we'd like to ask. We threw out onto Twitter earlier today that you were coming on, and asked if anyone had any questions. It's quite a simple one, but I've added a slight twist to it. So Ruth Ramsden asks, what's the worst thing that you've ever seen on a cricket field? Interestingly, she put in brackets, and this can include something you've done, so I don't know if she had something in mind there. But I'd like to ask, in addition to the worst thing you've seen, what's the best thing that you've seen live on a cricket field?
Oh, man, the best thing I've seen live. I wrote an article about how the best innings I ever saw live was Ollie Pope's 158 not out for Surrey against Yorkshire with Joe Root and Johnny Bairstow playing. And you could see them both looking at him and going, oh my God, he's really good, isn't he? And he was about, when he was about 20. I mean, that was one of the best things I've ever seen in a cricket field live. Another one of the best things I've ever seen in a cricket field was Sylvester Clark late at night against Yorkshire. Had obviously been wound up by them, and it's really about 1982, and he just, I say he bowled like the wind, I think there might have been an element of chucking it like the wind at that stage, and I can say that because I love Sylvester, and God rest his soul, but yeah, he broke a stump, and he broke two people's hands, and I mean, was it the best thing, or was it the most terrifying thing I've ever seen? It was quite dark. That was amazing, but on my own cricket field, the worst thing that I've ever done on a cricket field, I can tell you, and I'm not proud of it. And I've told this story on air on County Game before, so chances are no one was listening. So I'll explain. I was captain of my team's second 11, and I had this fabulous left arm over the wicket bowler called Ramon. And he was properly quick, but young. And our first 11 was quite good. So you know what first 11s are like. They're all they're all called Toby, and they've all got lovely wives with blonde hair, and they all drive nice cars, and they're investment bankers, and they do all that kind of nonsense. And they look at the second 11, and they don't really believe in it. And if you tell them, I've actually got a really good player called Ramon here, they go, well, you know, I think we're perfectly fine, if you don't mind, with our 42-year-old Dobber, who's picked up 1,000 wickets in Division One for years. And we were playing against this side, Hawley. And
we played there the weekend.
Who did you play for?
I Don't Like Cricket Club is the name of our team. Sorry to derail the story, but Hawley was the team we played this weekend.
Oh, right.
Where I had the yips.
Yeah. Well, what's the chance of that happening? Well, dear old Hawley, I genuinely think he's probably dead now because it was about 1998, 99, and he was about 70. And this guy had been a stalwart of their first 11 for years. And he'd done that classic thing when he was about 60 and he'd gone to play for the second 11 and he'd just opened the batting and he could play, but as he got older, he didn't have any power. But he couldn't get him out. You just could not get this bastard out.
I know exactly who you're talking about. Not the person, but I know the player. No,
that man. Yeah. Really good player in his youth. Gone a bit weak and feeble. Sort of like, gone a bit Mr. Burns from Simpsons. But at the same time, you know, nothing straight was going to get him out. He was never going to play at anything 3 inches outside off stump. He was just genius judgment, even though he had cataracts and all that. And we'd scored. It had one of those rare games when we'd done really well. We'd scored about over 200 and declared and given them 54 overs or so to knock it off. And they were 90 for seven. And this bastard just would not go. He just would not. He'd open the batting and he had nothing he could do about it. And then he started walking down the pitch to Ramon, left arm over, quick. And I said to him, what are you doing? Why don't you wang it in short at his head, for God's sake? Just, you know, this old bloke's taking the piss out of you. And Ramon, who just so you understand, he's now a very successful lawyer, but at the time he was quite, you know, like quite street. You know, he said to me in the changing room on that very day, he said, "You know, Bob, do you know what, Dan? You was the most deformed man I've ever seen. What is not officially deformed?" So, you know, he was a man who had who spoke his mind.
Yeah.
At the age of 17, 18.
A few airs and graces.
But he had a fantastic action, wonderful limbs, and he could ping it down at unbelievable speed. And he kept on pitching it up. So I said, "You've got to wang it in him. You've got to, like, just knock his block off. I'm not having this anymore. We need the 16 points. We're third from bottom in Division 4 of the second 11 of the Surrey Championship. We could go down to the fifth division. That is not acceptable on my watch, Ramon. Take him out." So, "Are you sure, Skip?" I said, "Yes, I'm absolutely bloody sure, because this guy's been batting for like 35, 40 overs and been boring the shit out of it." So he goes back to his office, takes a deep breath. He runs in. Bloke takes two paces down the wicket, a la Ben Stokes against Mohammed Abbas. And Ramon bowled it quicker than Mohammed Abbas and into the pitch. And it flew up. And the bloke was genuinely startled and sort of tried to swat it away. Got a thick top edge. It's crashing into his left eyebrow. No helmet. He's an old guy, you know, 1998. They don't wear helmets. Smashed into his eyebrow. He fell down. Blood poured from his eye instantly. As he went down, his bat just flicked off the bale. And he lay on the ground, prone, with blood pouring out. And I instantly thought, "Oh my God, what the fuck have I done? I've killed someone for 16 points in Division 4 for the second 11 Surrey Championship. And it's only the beginning of August. I mean, if we'd won, we could win next week and we'd probably be out of relegation danger. Why have I gone so early?" And I go down really gingerly and I look at him and he's lying on a pitch. And my wicketkeeper was one of the chief noises in the Crown Prosecution Service, CPS. Alan Isles, lovely guy, maniac. And I think, "Fuck, I've killed him." And then suddenly this eye opened, you know, a bit like Dreyfus in Pink Panther film. Like, "Oh, he's alive." And he goes, "What happened?" And my wicketkeeper, respected lawyer, on about 100 grand a year, looks down at him and goes, "You went down a wicket to our fast bowler, got top edge into your face, not your own bail off, and you're fucking out."
Oh, brilliant.
And all this time, I'm now like feeling deeply embarrassed because I consider myself to be a reasonable, you know, Renaissance man. And I thought, how the hell do I deal with this? And Alan goes, just make sure he's given out. I said, "But Alan, we've got to get him to hospital." I said, No, he goes to hospital, he gets stitched up, he comes back, he'll be here in 15 minutes, he'll be blocking the shit out of it again. I don't trust this. Make sure you appeal. So as he's being dragged off by the two umpires, I went up to the umpires as we got like close to the boundary and I said, "Look, I'm really sorry. Are you okay, by the way, Roy? Yeah, really sorry to ask, but how's that?"
Yeah.
The umpire gave me the worst, most filthy look, but because he was a man of probity and decency, he had to stick the finger up. So
you should have got down on both knees for the appeal, I think.
It was 90 for 8. We won the game. I was going to say
that, just to check. Like,
it did have a happy ending.
All in vain, yeah.
But that was, I think that was the worst thing I've ever done on a cricket field, and I feel terribly bad about it. And it's very lovely to be able to get it off my chest with you, Bob.
Perfect. Yeah, I think that's an excellent way to end the show. So thank you for coming. Thank you for joining us, Daniel.
It was a pleasure.
As ever, you can find us at The Cricket Pod on Instagram and Twitter, or drop us an email, thecricketpod@gmail.com, and let somebody else know about The Cricket Podcast. Thanks for listening.
The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
Very good.